everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's July 2024, and you're listening to our milestone episode number 400, which is a conversation about the films of Christopher Nolan. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Tallon. He is an associate professor of theology at Houston Baptist University. He is also the author of The Poetics of Evil. Phil has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called Rage Against the Dying of the Light, Christopher Nolan's Fighting Filmography. And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Phil, it's good to have you back on the podcast.
Always very happy to be here, Melanie.
Well, this is a huge milestone for us. Phil was with us at the very beginning 8 years ago when we started, and now 8 years later, we're just hitting episode 400. That's just hard to wrap my mind around it, and just been thankful for Phil and all his insights into different films, and particularly, as you know, on this podcast, one of the things we do focus on is cultural apologetics, because it's pretty much how the younger generation is interacting with different ideas through film and television series, more than books, probably, and even things on social media. So today, as I mentioned, we're talking about, once again, Christopher Nolan, but more just bigger scope, looking at some of his themes that in his work, less than a particular film, but we will link the past podcasts that we have done on particular Christopher Nolan films. Now, some people might not realize, if they're just newer to his more recent stuff, that he really came into the zeitgeist around the end of the 90s, early 2000s with his film Memento, and that got him noticed. And then he did, of course, the Batman series and some like cult favorites like Inception and Interstellar. And then he kind of took a detour and did handled a realistic historical subject matter in Dunkirk and then also in Oppenheimer. But he is known for his sci-fi treatments like Inception and Tenet. And we've covered some of those things here, and Phil's covered some of them for us in the past. So just before we get into Christopher Nolan, though, I would just like to ask Phil why Christians should care, first of all, about Christopher Nolan films, and why does cultural apologetics, what's the significance of it? Why should Christians really be engaged in it?
Yeah, so I think maybe I'll start with the second part of the question first. So what is cultural apologetics? So apologetics is basically responding to people's intellectual, emotional, personal needs and questions that they have. And so giving answers is kind of how First Peter has it, for the reasons for the hope that we have. And so it's a reactive enterprise where we have these things that we know. We love the Bible and we understand Christian theology and why we should believe. And so then as people come to you with different questions, it really varies in terms of how you're going to respond. So some people have big intellectual questions. Is it even reasonable to think that God exists, or is the Bible trustworthy? And that's kind of what a lot of traditional apologetics is focused on: reasons for God's existence, answering the problem of evil, defending the trustworthiness of Scripture. But cultural apologetics is a little different in that it's really trying to interact with, to some degree, the messier world of the culture, right? All the forces around us that shape how we think and feel and act, and is very often looking at the texts, the works that a culture is producing as an expression of its longings and aspirations. And so some people might say, you know, cultural apologetics is a bit like Paul in Acts 17 standing on Mars Hill, where he sort of says, oh, well, as your own poets have said, and then he quotes from the poets to point people to the true God. And so very often cultural apologetics is looking at the longings and desires, the needs that are expressed in the culture, to show how they can be fulfilled in the Christian worldview and life and practice. But there's also an element of discerning what's going on in the culture in order to critique or to warn about some dangers there. So listening carefully to say not just, oh, here's the yes, as your own poets have said, but oh, here's the no. Well, this is not going to lead to your flourishing and happiness. And so cultural apologetics is, I think, then concerned with intellectual questions, but also with emotional issues, as well as people's felt sense of the world. And so helping people not just to see the truth of the Christian faith, but also to feel its beauty and its goodness as well. And I think that's where the arts can be really helpful, because great art can help to enrich our experience, give us new ways of seeing, but also to feel powerfully some important truth. And so that's why I like interacting with films, because they hit us so powerfully, and they're a great touchstone and a conversation starter as well. Oh, let's all talk about the themes in this movie. And it's maybe a little bit less of a confrontational way to have a conversation about big issues.
I think that's true, because, you know, as modernity has marched on, some of the water cooler issues of our day in terms of just pop culture come from films or series that people are watching more than books that they're reading.
Yes, well, I think that's right. I mean, that there, and even film is becoming a little bit of a boutique and an artsy medium. So much attention is now on social media and YouTube and a lot of other forms, but it still is a huge form of mass entertainment, one of our biggest exports, and it's big business and worth attending to. And so filmmakers like Christopher Nolan are worth paying attention to, because they're telling the stories our culture is celebrating. So Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer won Best Picture. He's the seventh highest grossing director of all time. That includes a lot of people who've been in the game longer than he's been. So a lot of people are watching his movies. They're fan favorites. So The Dark Knight is a lot of people hold up as the best superhero movie ever made, or comic book movie ever made. So he's a significant figure who doesn't just enter into the cultural conversation, but often shifts the cultural conversation. Things that he's passionate about, he's able to get a lot of other people interested in as well. He's a very thoughtful filmmaker. And so his work also repays the intentionality of attending to what he's saying, because he's thinking about big ideas and wants to get those across. And so he's got stuff on his mind, and I think we should be listening to what he has to say. Sometimes to affirm, but sometimes to say, well, actually, there's a problem here, and let's follow through the implications of this, and offer maybe a more hopeful story for people to enter into.
I think it's really true for the younger generation, especially, you know, for sure millennials, but they're in their 40s now, but particularly Gen Z, that consumes so much of their media. They're kind of like digital natives, and they consume so much media, not just social media, but just through a lot of series. And it's interesting, it seems like that generation is rediscovering all the classic films and directors and even music. You can find a lot of the younger generation. I have some of those Gen Z people in my family, my children, and they've rediscovered a lot of media and art from the 70s, because, you know, they're tired of certain forms that become pop culture now. And so there's some real longevity. And as a matter of fact, my youngest son, he had loved the Nolan films, but hadn't even heard of Memento, which came out before he was born. So that was an experience to, like, let's watch Memento together. What do you think about this?
Younger generation still paying attention to movies and thinking about them and going back and discovering things. I think this is also the case in music. I'm often surprised at the college students I meet who kind of systematically go through the history of music. They have access to a lot of this stuff just through Spotify. You know, it's easy for them to just, you know, go back and find an artist and listen through everything that they've done. And so film isn't dead yet. It's our great American art form, and seems like it'll continue to be a notable world force. And people who are wondering, maybe movies dead after the pandemic, boy, we showed that's not the case when this last summer, when you had the Barbenheimer matchup, Barbie and Oppenheimer coming out the same weekend. And so I was there at the theater and I saw all the people dressed up like Barbie going into one theater and, you know, a bunch of other folks going into Oppenheimer. Some people hitting both films in the same day to get the full experience.
Yes, my youngest son and his friends did the full experience, and that was pretty long to watch both of them in one day. It really is hard to believe that 8 years ago, the Postmodern Realities podcast started with our very first episode and first guest, who was Phil Tallon. And we talked about the films of Quentin Tarantino way back at the beginning. And since that time, over 400 episodes, we have brought you all kinds of subjects from theology, from evaluating teachings both within the church and without the church. We've talked about world religions. We've done a lot with cultural apologetics. What are people watching on television? What about social media trends? And all these different things that we have covered for you over these past 8 years. If you're a new listener, there is a wealth of information and content that we've covered over the years, all with corresponding articles. And I would highly suggest that you go and look at our back catalog because really, we have covered so many things that we probably have something there for everyone. And if you're just discovering us, you've got many hundreds of hours of content to listen to if you go all the way back even to episode one, and there's a lot to choose from. So we have also changed over those 8 years. We were starting out to promote various articles that we had published at the time only in our print magazine. And since then, after 45 years, we've ceased our print magazine and we are only publishing online now. But most importantly, it's free. It's free for everyone. And we have new content every single week. So that's probably about 52 articles a year. There might be one or two weeks that we don't publish something, but almost 50 articles or around then. To give to you and to Christians to help you develop discernment skills, to know what the essentials of the Christian faith are, what you believe, why you believe it, and how to evaluate teachings that you see against essential Christian orthodoxy. And so we hope that these articles and podcasts are equipping for you. And also during that 8 year span. Just most recently in 2024, we started a new podcast called Christian Research Journal Reads, which is audio articles. So all of our articles we hope to work through over the years, and that is presented to you not as an interview with the author, but the actual text of the article in audio form. So that's available wherever you get your favorite podcasts or at our website, equip.org. So I would like to make my usual pitch to you, but really, to have you help us celebrate our 400 episodes. Now, normally I was thinking you would give us a gift if it's somebody has a big celebration. I think the biggest gift you could give us is one of two things. One would be to consider giving us a tip, because when we combine your tip with the tips of others, we can help to contribute to the budget that we have for the journal, where we pay our authors and we help defer the costs of these podcasts that we put out there for content for you. But even bigger than that, the gift of your time to rate and review this podcast. I mentioned in our last episode, we only have two reviews for 2024. It'd be great if we could increase that by 10. So at the end of the year, we'd have the equivalent of one review per month. That would just be really encouraging to us, mainly because reviews, the more likes, the more of anything. As you know, that's how the internet works. It just works on popularity based on the algorithm and what people are looking for. So our content will come up for others if we have enough interaction with it, and that would become in the form of a review. So the best place to do that for us would be Apple Podcasts. We'd be so grateful. I know it's an extra step to perhaps sign up or to create a username, but we'd ask that you would consider giving us a gift for our big celebration of 400 episodes by doing that. But thank you. We could not be here. We could not continue to be here after 8 years without your support of just sharing our content, telling a friend, giving us a tip, and back when we were a subscription magazine subscribing. And just thank you so much for supporting us. And we hope that we have many more episodes ahead for us. And every time we have a milestone episode, I think we do it at 50. And when we reach a 50 of something and 100, so you'll get to hear back from Phil at 450, we'll feature Phil Tallon once again. But thank you so much for being a part of this journey on the past 8 years. And now back to my conversation with Phil Tallon about the films of Christopher Nolan. Well, now I'd like to talk more about Christopher Nolan's work in particular, beyond what we should think about for cultural apologetics. And some of his early films were more like existential, I guess, film noir stories. They had these lonely protagonists trying to make meaning in a difficult world that they lived in. So what about his early work? What did the early films tell us about what Nolan was interested in and his worldview at the time?
So he started making movies in college at the University College of London. He was a lit major, and so Christopher Nolan's a reader. I think that shows the value of continuing to read as a source for inspiration and in film. But the big movie that launched him onto the scene was kind of came at the tail end of the independent film revolution, where these new filmmakers are being discovered and they're getting a really wide audience. And so he came at the tail end of that and came out with Memento, which got an incredible amount of critical buzz. It had a hard time getting picked up for distribution. And when it finally came out, then it became a cult favorite. And that movie is, so it's film noir. It's about kind of a lonely detective of sorts who's navigating treacherous people and dangerous women, and there's guns and a goal, and that things don't necessarily end well. And in that story, it was brilliant, and it showed everything that Nolan could do, and it was an incredibly promising entry because it was a creative story about a guy who had a head injury, and so he had retrograde amnesia. I mean, he couldn't form new memories, so every so often he would forget, what was going on. So I had to keep all these systematic little notes, post-it notes, and photographs, and he has tattoos on his body to remind him about his quest to find and kill the person who murdered his wife. And so you go through the movie in this very creative way where the movie begins chronologically at the ending and then moves backwards in these chunks. So each time the film shifts back, we the audience are disoriented, just like the main character is. What's going on? We don't really, recall. And then he gets oriented and we figure out, and then it continues to shift backwards. Brilliant movie. And that film concludes, I think, really tellingly for Nolan's perspective, with the main character discovering that that he actually already had found and killed his wife's murderer many years before, or attacker many years before, but he had forgotten it, and so he was being manipulated by somebody else to basically, as like a hitman, he would point him in a certain direction and go kill this person. And this is such a disturbing truth that he decides to forget this and just to set himself on a new quest, searching for someone else to kill. And so there you have a person who's looking for meaning in his life, right? He needs to have a mission. He discovers that the truth is dispiriting and doesn't leave him with any purpose. And so he decides to deceive himself in order to have that purpose in the world. And that shows this deep theme within Christopher Nolan's work, where he sees that reality is kind of in conflict with itself, which is that there are hopeful and good purposes that we might have, and then there's the despairing reality, and those two things don't often fit together. And so you have to choose kind of between truth or beauty very often in Nolan's work. And Nolan seems to see a kind of value in just ignoring the deeper truths in order to hold on to some shred of meaning. And you see that pop up, that theme, maybe not quite as powerfully in Memento, but you see that same theme pop up again and again throughout his films that he's directed, even films that he's produced. And it's an important theme to follow through because it really is, I think, a kind of a hallmark of a sort of a nihilistic worldview, you know. And so I might describe Nolan's characters as they're sort of old-fashioned heroes almost, but who are operating within a nihilistic universe. And so their situation is tragic in some deep sense.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, our listeners might be more familiar with his mainstream big budget type films, specifically his Batman films. So he took on the superhero movies and then some of the sci-fi that he did, like Inception. But I would say his take on Batman was something so different. It had always been in American pop culture in terms of television and film, a little bit more on the camp side of things. And so, you know, some of these themes that you were talking about carried on into these other films as his career went on, these superhero, more maybe popular cultural awareness films. So where do you see, like you were just mentioning, his nihilism woven into these Batman films or his other films like The Prestige and Inception? And not that many people have watched The Prestige, but it is really a very interesting film. And I know that once my youngest son got into the Nolan films, since so many kids had not seen The Prestige, he invited a whole big friend group over to watch it. So it might not be one that's known as much, but it falls into that category as he moved on into his career after Memento.
Yeah, well, people should go watch The Prestige. It's an interesting movie. It is a little bit overlooked in his canon. He's got the big actors in it, Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale and Scarlett Johansson. And of course, Michael Caine. There's a lot of his cast of characters that Christopher Nolan likes to use. And it's fascinating. It's one of his darkest and saddest films. And that theme of the conflict between truth and beauty is there as well. The story is about these turn of the century stage magicians who were friends and then become rivals, and and it's about the obsessive lengths to which these very disciplined people will go in order to achieve their art. And that's a through line that you find throughout Nolan's work. He's like this himself. He's an incredibly disciplined, hardworking person who goes to great lengths to pull off something great. But the way that the magicians in the movie articulate their goal is, they say, you know, people know that the world is solid, right? It's just kind of, there's nothing magical about it. But when you do a great trick, you cause them to wonder. You make them for a moment believe that there's something more. So they perform this illusion, right, that gives people a sense of wonder at the possibility of something greater, to help them forget the truth that deep down they all know, right? So that's almost like a metaphor for the creative act itself, what these characters do. And the film concludes with this incredibly tragic reality taking place, but then because of some of the ingenuity of one of the main characters, there's a kind of a happy illusion that's created afterward. I actually won't spoil this ending because I think it's worth people checking out, and it's a little bit less seen. But you have that same contradiction that is there in the Batman movies. Batman movies were this seen as this kind of gritty reboot of the series. Nolan took everything kind of back down to earth, so there's no super villains of a sort of normal stripe in the thing. There's definitely no Superman or, you know, people with superpowers. It's Bruce Wayne and his ingenuity and his obsession and some technology using the symbol of the bat in order to instill fear in the hearts of the people of Gotham. And so he has this dual identity where he, of course, he presents one face to the world as this playboy Bruce Wayne, and then he's also presenting this masked face to the criminals, and in order to inspire hope and to instill fear and inspire hope in the citizens of Gotham and fear in the hearts of its criminals. And so in the first movie is doesn't have this nihilistic element quite as strongly. But in the second movie, you do have, again, this theme of deception in order to give people hope. And so at the end of The Dark Knight, I assume most people have seen it, made a huge amount of money, it's incredibly popular. The Harvey Dent has lost his mind. He's going around murdering people vigilante style. He's doing what Batman doesn't do, which is to kill people, and certainly to kill with a gun. But Harvey Dent was supposed to be Gotham's White Knight, right? The hope that Bruce Wayne had, that maybe he could step away from being Batman. But now Harvey is tarnished. And so at the end of the movie, Batman decides, together with Jim Gordon, that they'll blame Batman for these crimes in order that Gotham can still have this hopeful lie that Harvey Dent was good to the end. And so he tarnishes his own reputation. They commit this sin of deception in order that people could still have hope. Of course, I think, you know, Nolan thinks that, you know, this doesn't really work long term. And so in The Dark Knight Rises, all those lies are unmasked to great disaster. And the mask that Batman wears is ultimately torn away. Everybody sees through his deception. And so the power of illusion and deception only goes so far. In the end, the truth will eventually out. But it's a very kind of modern, disenchanted perspective on superheroes. So you kind of, at the end of the day, there's some inspiring things, but reality itself is not all that inspiring. And so you often have to deceive people in order to give them some hope to hold on to.
So thinking about some of his more recent films, you mentioned Oppenheimer in the intro. They're a little bit more grandiose. They've got these big scope, whether it's world wars in Dunkirk or nuclear war, the potential for that in Oppenheimer. Does anything in these films show us about how his worldview has progressed? Maybe what he's interested in right now, specifically taking on, since his Batman series, real life events and people in Oppenheimer and in the famous battle at Dunkirk, which is, it's such a moody film almost. It's probably not what people would be used to if they've not seen Dunkirk already. It doesn't have much dialogue in it. And also just the intensity and the deep dive into Oppenheimer and his life in the film that won the Oscar this year.
Yeah, Dunkirk is a great movie and really worth really seeing. It's also, I think, one of his shortest, maybe since his first movie, 97 minutes or something like that. It's a really short film. Uses a lot of the stylistic elements that we've seen before, especially non-chronological storytelling. So you have the stranded British soldiers on Dunkirk Beach, and France is losing the war. The Germans are encroaching, so they've got to get them out of there in order to regroup and then rally. And the story takes place over the course of a week in the lives of the soldiers that are there on the beach as they attempt to get off, a day of some just British citizens who take boats across the channel in order to rescue as a kind of just a civilian fleet, and then an hour with fighter pilots who are protecting the people who are there on the beach as they do have various dogfights in the air. And it's, yeah, so it does signal the shift. I mean, Nolan's taking on a little bit more of just the world history. There's this grander scope. So you've seen, you know, from early on, you have to make smaller movies. So he's got these smaller film noir, and then we shift to science, you know, science fiction, some bigger stories. And now we're talking about world wars and nuclear war with Oppenheimer. And watching Dunkirk revealed to me, I think that something that is, I think is important to understand about Nolan, which is that he's English himself. His father is English, but he was schooled in Britain. I think his mother's American, and so they're a little bit, and he's got dual citizenship. But there's something about that English identity, that British identity that that resisted Hitler and the Germans against incredible odds with real steel resolution. And he is fascinated by heroes who are just kind of, you know, pushing against the world itself, you know, who are willing to sacrifice and to fight. And we see that that fighting spirit in Dunkirk, especially in the words of Churchill at the end. And we also see it tested as we see soldiers give way to cowardice or self-preservation. But we're to admire the fighting spirit. But that was what helped to win the World War. And so it's a very noble film, and I think an inspiring film, even though it's about a defeat in a certain way, a retreat of the, by the soldiers. It's a beautiful story of just regular people, you know, rallying together to save these soldiers. And I think that's important to bear in mind because it's Nolan has a strong admiration for people who sort of summon the will and the ingenuity in order to achieve something important and great. So his movies, most of his movies are kind of like boys' movies, right? They're stories of heroes who are, you know, taking on great great tasks, and maybe that's one of the reasons that I like them. I'm still just a boy at heart, and I resonate with those things. But is yeah, so all his movies since Dunkirk have had this really grand scale. Interstellar is about a mission to find a new home for the people of Earth, because Earth in this science fiction movie is kind of got like a worldwide dust bowl where crops are dying and people are starving, and they've got to find this new place to go. And so they've set off on this heroic quest at great sacrifice. And then there's also a deception theme in there, because the people of Earth have been misled, according to the great scientist, Dr. Brand, who's supposedly come up with a formula that will enable them to take these huge ships with all the people of Earth on them as they go for their to find the home that the explorers have prepared for them. But it turns out that the second part of the formula is a lie. It wasn't finished. It was just given in order to give people the hope to support the mission to take just a few people to go and continue the species somewhere else. But because this is a Hollywood movie, they do in fact discover the second part of the formula and are able to save everyone. So there's this big universal scope, and then also that theme of the conflict between truth and what is hopeful and inspiring. And you could also fold Inception into that kind of grand story as well, which is that it is a really ambitious film. I think it's probably Nolan's most successful movie overall, that is incredibly fantastic. And of course, it takes place within the very small space of dreams, but it's about people who are fighting to, this guy is fighting to get home, right? So the main character has been wrongly accused of murder. And the only way he's going to be able to fix all of this is if he pulls off this one big heist. And there again, as the movie concludes, this famous ending underscores exactly that same theme of the kind of the conflict between what is hopeful and what is true. And so Nolan has got this on his mind. He is a filmmaker who's working with all the sort of contradictions and difficulties that come from living in an age of contested hope and a kind of a post-Christian worldview. But he still admires the old virtues of courage and heroism. So you see that in Dunkirk, you see that in Inception, you see that in Interstellar, and you see that in Tenet, his movie that came out right as the theaters were opening back up after the pandemic, and it didn't do well. It probably wouldn't have done well anyway, but I think because of the pandemic, it wasn't chalked up as his failure particularly. And as a really twisty, fascinating Bond-style film about people who are trying to avert the end of the world using not time travel, but reversing one's movement in time in order to act as kind of agents of providence to stop a cataclysm from happening. So Nolan is now painting on sort of the grandest canvases possible. And he continues to achieve great success in this. And I have no doubt that, you know, his next movie will also be something that's very big and very likely to be successful as well.
So you've mentioned a couple of times the nihilistic elements in his film, but are all of his movies hopeless and have like despair to its main, you know, point? Or does he have any kind of glimmers of hope in his work? I mean, how has he balanced maybe what we would say light and darkness in his movie, despair and hope?
You find that there is an alternation. So Memento is a more despairing movie. Insomnia is a more hopeful movie. It still ends kind of sadly, but without with a resolution of the conflict between truth and beauty. And then the Batman is more hopeful. Dark Knight ends more darkly. The Dark Knight Rises ends more hopefully. So often kind of balance out those tones. The Prestige, as I said, is a much more tragic and despairing ending, where Inception, it feels more hopeful, even though there's still some unresolved questions. And yeah, Dunkirk and Interstellar are much more positive, as is Tenet. And I think it's interesting that his most critically successful movie, though, is Oppenheimer, is one of the darker one of his darker movies. So you see there's a kind of a wrestling or a tension within Nolan's work, where he's sometimes the darkness wins, sometimes light wins, though the light rarely wins without taking some serious wounds or maybe with deep sacrifice. So he's good about kind of keeping us guessing which way he'll go. If he takes on a Bond movie, he'd probably... that one's probably going to end pretty positively. Those things tend to turn out well.
I don't know that I think that he would, I guess, be tapped to do a Bond movie. I don't know. I think they're very specific. But I do think Interstellar is one of his more hopeful works. And maybe it's because it's really rooted in a story about a family.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because the material didn't originate with Nolan. It was originally a Spielberg movie. And so you can kind of see some of that Spielbergian DNA in there, which is the emotionality. Nolan's movies tend to be more conceptual and a little more clinical in a certain way. Where, you know, there's so much emotion in Interstellar, these big scenes. Of course, there's the famous meme scene of Matthew McConaughey weeping as he watches 20 years of updates come from his children, and he watches them grow old and in very quick succession. And it raises even the question of maybe is there some force of love in the universe, you know, something that's actually operative. And I don't think it answers that question, but it at least raises that possibility. And so depending on where his material is coming from, you know, you can see some of these different influences. You know, Oppenheimer kind of being one of the most notable ones, based on a biography. And so it's actually fairly faithful to a lot of the tensions that were there in Oppenheimer's life. But so he, you know, his source material still influences, but it's so shaped by his mind overall. He serves as basically the final writer on all of his scripts. He's heavily involved. He's not a director for hire, comes in, takes on a script. Everything is kind of shaped through his particular vision. And so, but it is interesting to think about Interstellar as you can kind of see how it could be a Spielberg project, especially with its hopefulness and positivity and longing to explore the vastness of the universe and see what else is out there.
It's a very humanistic film, I think.
Indeed.
For sure. And like you said, since it was set to have Spielberg originally direct, maybe, you know, like you said, he's involved in screenplays, but maybe he didn't do a huge overhaul. There's maybe echoes that we see of Steven Spielberg in that film, for sure, especially thinking about, you know, space, and not just space, but just some of the themes that he's wrestled with. And you've dealt with us before, dealt with Spielberg, so we'll link that one in the past that we talked about, because, I don't know, I think it's adjacent to that a little bit.
No, Spielberg is kind of an optimist and loves to think about space and extraplanetary beings as a way to connect with the wider universe. And he's fascinated and wonders at the beauty and vastness of things consistently. And so there's a, kind of a maybe a negotiation there in certain ways between what, between the optimism of the film and some of the sort of deep tensions that Nolan is always exploring. That actually, Interstellar originally, it was there's scientist Kip Thorne who wanted to do a more realistic science fiction film, and so Jonathan Nolan, Christopher's brother, was brought on to be the scriptwriter. So Nolan was aware of it, and then when Spielberg dropped out, he picked it up, and then was and then made some additions and changes. Okay, here's some other things that I've been thinking about and added. And so adapted it a good bit. So it's always fascinating. We see these cross-pollinations between directorial projects. Of course, Spielberg's own AI is a really fascinating example where he, it was originally a Kubrick movie and then Spielberg picked it up. And so you can kind of see this, this tug of war within the film between those two filmmakers that are happening on the screen.
Actually, I was thinking of AI when I was thinking about Interstellar. I was thinking there's some, with the future thing and different beings and what is out there and what does that mean for humanity? I just, before you mentioned, I was thinking about, well, I would kind of relate AI to Interstellar. But we talked a little bit about Oppenheimer. You didn't cover it for us, but it was a big commercial and critical success. We are going to link also in the show notes the podcast that we did on Oppenheimer and the article we have. But where does it fit into Nolan's filmography? And basically, I mean, it won Best Picture. I think he was overdue. I think that he's eluded him with his other films. And so finally, he was rewarded for this one, which I think was well deserved in its scope and its ambition as a film.
Yeah, he won Best Director, and the film was Best Picture, the other accolades as well, and it he had finally come due. And that's often how Oscars work, is they're very often actually awarding the Oscar for a previous accomplishment. But in this case, I think it really it was the right film to award. I think that Oppenheimer is Nolan's most mature movie. It is, as I said, kind of one of the ones that stands out as not being sort of a boy's heroic film. You have a very complicated figure in Robert Oppenheimer. So it's not bad guys and good guys. They're combined, and Oppenheimer is both at once. He's brilliant, he's troubled, he's a womanizer and a pragmatist, but he also has he's fascinated by ideas. He does have principles. He's got, moral concerns, but he just can't pass up the opportunity to be involved in this incredible project and to lead it as he builds the bomb. And they're continually suppressing their kind of concerns about what the implications might be in order to get first, get the bomb first in the war effort. And he finds these justifications for continuing developing it even after the Germans are defeated. And then is almost immediately haunted by the reality of what he's done, right? That he's unleashed this new technology, which truly for the first time in world history has the possibility of exterminating, huge numbers of people on Earth. And he sees where this is going. And so then he's trying to kind of put the toothpaste back in the tube afterward. Oh no, we need to work to cooperate and prevent nuclear weapons from proliferating and slow down development. And of course, it's too late, right? He's unleashed this thing on the world. And that's the, so if you have their biography on which it's based is the American Prometheus. And it opens with this statement about Prometheus who brings fire down from the gods and then is tortured for it, right? That's what happens to Oppenheimer is he creates this new form of fire and from the material of the universe. And then he's tortured about what he's done. But it's also Pandora's box, right? He's opened up this thing and there's no putting the world back the way that it was. And this is, so many of Nolan's movies are kind of self-contained. They don't make us think about the real world. Maybe they make us think about reality, but they're not that representational about things that happen in life. But Oppenheimer is redirects our attention to a something that is very real, which is that there are an incredible number of nuclear weapons out there. There's always the possibility of nuclear war. We're a little less concerned about it than we were when I was growing up during the Cold War. We thought, This could happen at any moment. But in that regard, it does strike me as being a helpfully moral film in that it's drawing our attention to a problem that we have. And it doesn't offer simplistic answers to the solution. There's real tension there in the film. But Nolan is pointing out something that is a grand issue. Some people would say Oppenheimer is the most important person who ever lived. And I think Nolan has even said that just because of the accomplishment of creating nuclear weaponry. In terms of the ability to profoundly change the world, nuclear weapons may be the most significant technology ever made. And so it's a grand film and beautifully made. So all the stylistic elements of Nolan's stuff, right? Pounding score, really well used throughout, incredible practical visuals. They've, you know, set off all these explosions, did all these things in order to capture the effect of a nuclear weapon or give us a look into the quantum world. It's non-chronological storytelling in order to create this powerful effect. And it really is the work of a filmmaker who's working at the top of his game with kind of all the power of Hollywood, who knows what he's doing, and he's got the best actors and has created a really significant achievement. So it deserved Best Picture. It's, again, I think it's a little bit outside of Nolan's head, whereas, you know, a lot of his other works are, you know, feel very much philosophical and contemplative, like where Oppenheimer is pushing us back out the doors in the world to think a bit about how we should live and what we should do.
So how would the Christian apologists use Christopher Nolan's work to point to the truth of Christianity, to point to the true story?
Yeah, well, so I think as this interview would indicate, and as my article will as well, obviously I want to draw people's attention to this nihilistic element within his work, because I think that's something that we should discern. As we enjoy his movies, we should not take on those ideas as being, you know, helpful ways to think about reality itself. And so we should be on guard for those things, and to kind of to point that out, okay, you know, this here suggests a non-Christian way of viewing the world if we took it on. And so that's the first step, I think, could just be one of kind of caution. Okay, well, you know, we should be aware of this. But there are other opportunities for dialogue as well, right? Okay, well, why do you think that there is this tragic conflict between truth and goodness? Don't you want to hear about a more beautiful story where truth, the ultimate truth, is beautiful, right? Where though there are many difficult and tragic things that happen in our lives, at the end of the day, there is ultimate hope and meaning and purpose that's satisfying. It's not just found in the survival of the species, the survival of a person. It's found in survival beyond death. And so I think there's a way we can dialogue and offer something that's more satisfying. And then there are things to affirm in his movies as well. You have, I think, admirable and heroic characters who are disciplined, who are intelligent, and who address problems and go after them and are sacrificial in their willingness to do so. And so Nolan is giving us the kind of heroic stories that I think that we also need to inspire our own self-sacrifice at times. And so there's a good old-fashioned heroism that we can affirm. So that's where you know, you can look at certain things and say, well, no, but here's some other possibility, or yes, and, oh, look, this is good, and let's affirm that. But you want to make sure we eat the meat and spit out the bones, as they say.
Well, can you tell us anything about what's coming next for Christopher Nolan, for listeners who really enjoy his film and really liked Oppenheimer too and want to know what he's up to for his next projects?
We don't know. Probably not anything to do with superheroes. He's got a couple of projects on his plates. There's this possibility of him taking on the Bond reboot. You know, that would be a little bit unusual, because typically the Broccoli family who produce that don't attach superstar directors, but you could sort of see him coming on as providing a new template and direction for the series. Maybe it's just too good to pass up, get people interested in Bond again. He apparently likes this old British television show called The Prisoner. I like it as well. It's a really fascinating, low budget, themey, artistically interesting old series that I recommend people check out, because it's fascinating. He may do that as well, but I don't know. I think I would imagine normally Nolan is very private. He doesn't, you know, put a lot of information about himself out there. and normally likes to work on one thing at a time. So if I had to put money on it right now, I'd say I would put money on him being in discussion with the producers of the James Bond series. And that's one of the reasons we haven't heard. Who knows if that'll work out or not. But I think that if I had to bet, that's what I would bet on.
I don't know about that. I think Barbara Broccoli is quite particular. So we'll see. I guess I'm going to vote he's not going to do it, or they're going to end up not collaborating, but we'll see. He's a very independent filmmaker, and the Broccolis are very hands-on with their Bond franchise.
Indeed. But Nolan has pointed to, you know, those Roger Moore movies being a really big influence on him. He's already, his style of working, he already kind of is making Bond movies. So you look at Inception or Tenet, you know, they're basically Bond stories. I think he knows how to do it. And the possibility of attaching the hottest current working director to your series when he's such a good fit and his style works so well, I think would just be really tantalizing. And I think there's concern about the Bond franchise. Where is it actually going to go? How are they going to be able to continue this in the future? And Nolan is promising for that.
Well, finally, I have a fun rapid fire question for Phil. So Phil, the Hollywood strikes are over and movies are back in theaters. Is there anything you're looking forward to seeing this summer, even if it's just something that's a light popcorn kind of thriller or superhero or big IP type of film?
That's a great question. I mean, just some of the movies that I wanted to see, I already have seen. So I was looking forward to Richard Linklater's new film Hitman, which came out on Netflix. I do want to see Furiosa, but I have not gotten out to the theater. And we watched the Fall Guy, which is light and unserious, but delightful enough. I'm interested in the new Yorgos Lanthimos movie, Kinds of Kindness. I'm not going to say recommend people go out and watch that, but Lanthimos is fascinating. And there are a couple of independent horror movies, because that's an interest of mine that I've already checked out and will continue to watch. So that's maybe a bit more than of an answer that you'd wanted. But I will say, if people are looking for a movie to check out that's light, that's enjoyable, a kind of unserious action movie, The Fall Guy is enjoyable and fairly family friendly. So,
yes, I don't know if we could recommend any Yorgos Lanthimos films on this.
No, don't. Yeah, that's
for sure a very unconventional filmmaker.
Yeah, he's a very interesting filmmaker and is excellent, but proceed with caution for Lanthimos' movies.
Exactly. Well, thanks, Phil, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast, all the way back to the very beginning and our first episode 8 years ago.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to our big milestone episode 400 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Philip Tallon of Houston Baptist University. Phil has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal about our discussion today, and his article is called Rage Against the Dying of the Light, Christopher Nolan's Fighting Filmography. And you can read his article completely free, no paywall, at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.